This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Thank you and welcome to another episode of Voices in Validation brought to you by the IVT Network. This week, we offer once again Risk Revolution, which is a monthly series of Voices in Validation. And the goal of this series is to advance the maturity of risk management practices within the industry as we cover topics that challenge quality professionals to seek opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, our series coordinators, Lori and Nula, invite their guest, Tiff Baker, to chat about facilitators. Are they friend or foe? We'll dive in today with about the importance of facilitation in the risk management process and how it leads to the success of a risk assessment. So welcome to all of you. It's so great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you
very thanks, much. Stacey. Thanks. It's great to be back again, as always. And this month, we are getting tactical, and I'm so looking forward to exploring facilitation of risk assessments with our guest, Tiff, today. When we last met, we discussed root cause analysis tools and processes with Rob from the commercial nuclear industry. And that was really a great opportunity to share some practices from outside the pharma industry. We got some great feedback on that. But today we are going to jump into the facilitator role in the whole risk management process. And, you know, just like our root cause analysis activities, the right facilitator is such a critical factor in the whole risk management process of getting to those right answers. What do you think, Lori?
Yeah, so having been a facilitator myself several times, I'm excited about today's episode, also to hear about both you and Tiff's perspectives on things as well, and kind of jump into what are those tips and tricks that we can share with people that each of us have used and learned over the years as well. So yes, I'm very excited about today. And Tiff?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so to your points, the facilitator role is even more important today than it used to be. I think we learned a lot in the COVID and hopefully soon the post-COVID era, where remote facilitation is becoming really important. That paradigm shift seems like it's going to be here to stay. And so I think to kind of add on to the last podcast you guys had, it's about things evolving over time, right? And so while root cause analysis evolved over time and it has to be thought about in a different way, to a certain extent, so does facilitation. And I'm excited to talk about that with you guys today.
Great. Thank you. And welcome to this podcast today, Tiff. We're excited to have you as well. So let's go ahead and jump in. And I thought we'd start off with our most favorite ugly story about facilitation, because we've probably either committed it or been a part of it, and kind of get us some groundwork on what didn't work out so well so that we can kind of get going from there. So I'll share first just because, and at risk of being vulnerable, it was me that committed the cardinal sin of walking into a risk assessment with a blank Excel spreadsheet. And I'm pretty sure we've all told everyone that we've ever coached to never do that. But I did that because it was the first one I had ever done. And so I walked in pretty excited, having my FMEA spreadsheet set down with about five or six other people. And there we were staring at that blank Excel spreadsheet projected onto the wall. So, and then realizing this was really not going to go anywhere. So that was my best learning experience, I will say, from a facilitation perspective, because when you commit those sins, I'll call them, you learn from it, right? You sort of go back and go, that didn't go so well. And here's the reasons why that didn't work. And so while I never did it again, I also remember it so that I never also coach anyone to do that. But what I then coach people what to do to prepare for that risk assessment. So that was kind of my horror story. Nula, what have you experienced or committed yourself?
You know, just thinking about this, Lori, you know, we could turn this into a whole week-long episode here with all the horror stories I've had around risk assessments. And of course, you know, the first thing that we have to remember is that, of course, for many people, when we talk about quality risk management, all they think about is the risk assessment. That's the only piece of the that they think about. And perhaps that's because that's the only piece that they've ever really had an engagement in when they're invited to a risk assessment. And the groans start from when the email goes out. So you're getting immediately, you're seeing all of the excuses, the dog ate my homework, you know, I'm going to be leaving the country for an undisclosed length of time. I do not want to participate. There's a day or two of my life I'm never getting back, is generally speaking, you know. And very often it's the QA exec or the QRM lead or someone who's trying to beat these folks, you know, these cross-functional teams into the room. And they just, you know, it's not something that they see. The other driver very often for these is, even if we're, you know, at the best of times, you know, looking at a new product introduction or a new piece of equipment being commissioned and validated, you're looking at it prospectively. But of course, many of the risk assessments that we get involved in are, you know, investigations or impact assessments, or perhaps change after something hasn't worked so well, you know, that the, and then, you know, you've got that whole blame culture sitting lurking in the room as well, like a bad smell, and nobody wants to fess up to why something went wrong in the first instance. So trying to get the cross-functional team in there, you've got people kicking their heels getting in the door. They're looking at their, what, you know, and I'm aging myself now. It started out with they were looking at their pagers on site. Now, of course, they've all got their smartphones and whatever, you know. And, you know, you can almost tell that they're, you know, they've asked their buddy to call them within a half an hour to get them out, you know, they just don't want to be there. And then you've got the SMEs, those wonderful folks, we're going to talk about those later, but they can have so many chips and baggage on their shoulders coming in that, you know, they may have been invested in the original design and it's their baby. And you just told us about talking about ugly stories. They don't want to hear that the design was an ugly child, you know, their favorite design was an ugly child. So there's a whole host of things that can get you off on the wrong foot ever before you sit down to start looking at the actual risks themselves. So, yeah. What about you, Tiff?
Yeah, agreed. And so I think, you know, before I start here, I totally forgot at the top to thank you guys for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here with you. But in terms of horror stories, I think we've all got some. And I think they're really good ways to learn. And they're good ways to kind of see into an organization in some instances. I've had some where I've been pulled kind of out of the hallway to start doing an assessment. And to get thrown into something, to your point, Lori, totally unprepared, is really kind of jarring to watch them go through your beginning process. But I think also this particular assessment was one that didn't have a whole lot of senior management support behind it. And so some SMEs didn't feel like they had to come at all. We ended up spending probably 2 or 3 times more than we needed to get the assessment done, because we were trying to pull people in and engage people. And it was a good learning experience that, you know, you have to make sure that that engagement is all the way to the top to understand the importance of something that you're going to be doing. Absolutely.
I think you bring up a good point too about that sort of being thrown into something. I think this kind of role got me more comfortable with that. You know, I would spend much more time in the past, which I still do when I'm, obviously, if you're sitting down and you have a lengthy risk assessment, you spend a lot of prep time, and we'll talk about that. But I find myself much more accustomed now to being able to sort of adjust a little bit more, because this role kind of requires that at times, given the emergency type of situation, and you're trying to make a decision really quickly. So that's kind of been the key, I think, excuse me, lesson that I've sort of learned from it too. But okay, so now that we've shared our awful stories and we're still trying to determine whether that facilitator is friend or foe, Tiff, why don't you kick us off with kind of what do we mean by the role of facilitator? Let's ground ourselves now and what our expectations are for that role.
Sure. I think that there's a lot of different instances where you could have a facilitator. I think we'll focus in obviously on the risk facilitator here. And I think just because I'm not sure the knowledge base of all of our listeners, maybe we'll ground people that the risk facilitator is really meant in instances where we have a formal risk assessment. As you get a little bit less formal, they're not as required. So when you have simple things for quality systems input or change control, something simple, you wouldn't necessarily need one. But when you're looking at those big complex assessments, if you're looking at something that's got a lot of stakeholders or something that's using a formal methodology, we're going to want that facilitator. And they kind of wear a lot of hats in throughout this process of the facilitation. They start out as a project manager, right? So they run the prep work. They help coordinate who needs to be there. They determine who your owners are sometimes. They determine kind of what data needs to be brought in, and they contact those people ahead of time to make sure that it's ready. I think it's a great thing for a facilitator to have enough confidence to not hold a session if they don't have that stuff. So that's a really good kind of expectation for a facilitator. They have to be a little bit confident in their own skill set. A colleague once told me when I was first training in FMEA methodology that it's the role of the facilitator to take the burden of that tool methodology off of your SMEs. And I think that's really important too. The SMEs need to understand from you that the burden of that methodology is not on them. And likewise, the burden of the content is not on you as the facilitator. I think new facilitators get a little bit tripped up because they feel like they also have to be an expert in the process. And while it's helpful to be able to speak the language, you don't necessarily have to know all the answers. And it's probably better if you don't. You can ask a lot of better questions that way. And that kind of lends into asking questions. So apart from being that project manager, I think you have to be able to kind of remove your ego in a way, because you're going to want to ask the silly questions. You're going to want to ask the questions that make some of the SMEs kind of eyes roll at you. And I think to be able to walk in there and say, guys, I'm going to ask some really odd or interesting questions, and it may be something everybody in this room knows, but I just want to make sure we can document this stuff. I think it's really important. And that kind of goes along with playing that devil's advocate role at times to make sure that you can challenge people. And I think the last piece for an expectation of a good facilitator is the ability to manage a group of SMEs. I think, you know, there was an instance, it was during COVID time that I was facilitating a risk assessment, and it was a really urgent, we had to do a lot of quick meetings. And so I invited who was urgent in that assessment to have as an SME pool. It was like 5 or 6 people. And then we saw the forwarded email message come back. And I had a risk assessment with 35, 40 people in it. And it was just wild. So the ability to manage that group, I think, you know, and this is where we're evolving into that, that remote space. So with that confidence comes the facilitator's confidence to set ground rules. You know, if you weren't an original invite, I'm going to mute you. That's a lot easier in a room. You can put, if you have this large group, you can put who you need kind of at that middle table and observers on the outside. But when you're in that remote space, I think having a little bit of confidence to set those boundaries is really important too. So the facilitator is really kind of the conductor of this, right? You're like the orchestra conductor, making sure that it runs smoothly.
I love that, because you described some of those behaviors too. And I will say too, the asking questions thing, we cannot emphasize enough. I think spot on. And several people have told me over the years, you ask a lot of questions. And so I feel like that makes me good then, right? It can be annoying because we're digging, like you said, Tiff, but we have to, because we're trying to take the burden of that tool off of you, and we're trying to use your brain. I think they're the content, right? You captured that perfectly. Nuala, so what are your thoughts on the facilitator role then?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everything that Tiff has said there. And, you know, there's a couple of, like you say, golden rules around facilitation. And for me, it's not just about the stepping into the room piece, to your story from earlier on, Laurie. So it's back to the fail to prepare, prepare to fail. So really the work of the facilitator starts, you know, depending on how big the activity is, sometime before that, you know, when you're starting to set up the schedule of events and who needs to be there, it's really around speaking to the risk owner, who, you know, establishing who that owner is, making sure you've got the leaders involved. And then with that risk owner, getting the scope right, because again, very often that scope creep can happen. People aren't clear on what problem they're solving for. So establishing those boundaries, scope, making sure you have all of the, you know, the physical information that can be necessary that can help to guide this. And I'm thinking, you know, floor plans, process flows, process maps, where you can mark your boundaries. You may need P&IDs for the system, you know, if it's a critical utility, you know, where are your boundaries? And having all of those marked up and being able to walk your way through those with the team at the beginning to say, you know, this is the area we're looking at. This is the specifics of what we're focusing in on. And having all that preparation done is super important. There's no point in going into a room with a group of people. You're wasting their time and your own time if that preparation isn't right. I would rather delay the risk assessment and get that prep done correctly than go ahead and try and meet the schedule for having folks in the room on the day, because you're going to be backpedaling at some point in time. The other credo I have around the actual risk assessment and the facilitation is right team, right tool, right time, right data. So that's my credo, you know, who's on the team, and making sure you have that right team there. And that can be as much as identifying who shouldn't be on the team sometimes, as well as who should be on the team. And in some cases, depending on the question that you're looking at, the most important people to have on the team are the people closest to the work, the people who understand the process, and particularly if it's a working process, the people who are closest to the work. And if it's not a working process, and by that I mean it's one that you're getting into commissioning a qualification or design, then making sure you have the people who will be doing the work in the room, who have experience with, you know, familiar similar equipment or similar processes, is really, really important. If it's a tech transfer, having people from the transferring and the receiving site there, not just the tech ops folks who are responsible for the, you know, the stewardship of the project. So right team. The other people who I don't necessarily want in the room at the beginning, other than doing the introduction and setting the scene, is the leaders. Actually, I'd like them to come in and thank everybody to for their time, set some kind of ground rules around making sure you're engaged, and then exit the process. And particularly if some of those leaders are decision makers, sometimes it's too early. If the decision makers are in the room, they're driving all the time trying to get to the decision. The emphasis is on the decision rather than really understanding the problem and understanding the data and exploring the risks or looking at the solutions. So that right team, right tool, obviously, as Tiffa said, you know, the facilitator can be the owner of the tool. They can be the driver of the tool bus. So picking the right tool is really important. And God knows, we know that, you know, my wish in the world, if a fairy godmother arrived, would be to take FMEA away from us until we're grown up enough to use it. But nevertheless, it's there. So, but, you know, we don't always need that, you know, blunt instrument of that complex FMEA. And we so many other lighter touch tools and more effective exploratory tools are available to us, and we should be using them. And you know, it's not a one tool, it's not a one trick pony either. Depending on what phase you are in the life cycle and what phase you are in the project, a lighter touch tool might be a better approach in terms of those brainstorming, simple risk ranking, you know, a whole host of things that you can be doing before you have to get into the nitty gritty of getting people to score RPNs on an FMEA. Right time, again, this is something that can novel a risk assessment. We think the project schedule calls it up, or the track wise, you're going to expire your 30 days on your investigation. And therefore that's driving the time. And if you don't have the right data or the right people aren't available, then you've got to be able to call that right time. The other side of the right time, a lot of the work that I do nowadays is in trying to encourage companies to be much more proactive in their risk management rather than, you know, stop the firefighting, more fire prevention. Sometimes that right time is we should be doing it much earlier, you know, and starting the investigations much earlier on day three or day two rather than waiting till day 30. And so getting in early and having an opportunity where you still have some road in front of you before the red or the checkered flag is going to come down is really important. And then, of course, right data. If you don't have the data, or you don't have access to the data, then go home. Don't, I mean, otherwise it's guessing. It's a guessing game, and guesstimates are no good. You cannot rely on good risk ranking when you're putting guesstimates in there. So the only way you can come up with an estimate of a probability of occurrence or something like that is if you can say, well, over the last 10 batches or the last 100 batches or the last 100 events, this is what happened. And on the basis of that, we can form an opinion. That's before we, and just coming back, I really liked that, what you said about asking questions. And again, that's another one of my credos. And it comes from Edgar Schein. A lot of the work and culture that I do comes from Edgar Schein. And he has a lovely book called The Art of Humble Inquiry. And effectively, the tagline on the book is ask, don't tell. And as a facilitator, that has to be your absolute golden rule. You're there to ask, not to tell. And to Tiff's point earlier on, it's actually helpful if you don't know the answers. That you're not the expert in the room, because then you're, and curiosity is key to that. You have to keep being curious and asking follow-up questions to make sure that you're shaking down the answers. And in that, again, that comes back to this old thing that I say regularly, consensus is the enemy of good risk assessment. So everybody being, oh, yeah, we all agree, groupthink, yeah, that's good. Let's move on to the next point. That's a killer for good risk assessment. So you want that curiosity. You don't, when I see consensus, that's when I want to start asking more questions. Are we really sure about that? And particularly if it comes too early in the phase. What you want is informed alignment at the end of the process, not this kind of groupthink at the beginning of the process. You know, and when you go around, you ask opinions and you hear something like, yeah, what she said, you know, or what he just said. Yeah, I agree with that. So certainly, and that brings in us back to all that bias and heuristics that we had that lovely set of episodes with Randy. So there, you know, I refer all our listeners back to those previous ones where we talked about, you know, human heuristics and human bias that can come into those decision makings. And just finally, you know, that expectation around setting challenges in there. I know this is another, people might say, oh my God, here she comes again with another crazy idea. But you know, the six hats concept where you can have somebody who's nominated to be the devil's advocate and somebody else who's nominated to be the curator of the data and somebody else who's nominated, and you can have different roles in there. And you can actually have a bit of fun with that by saying, okay, your job is to actually ask the ORCID questions. And therefore, there's no frustration saying, oh, God, why is he slowing this process down by asking that question? Because you've given him that role at the beginning, saying every ORCID question you ask, you know, that's your role. So some of those ground rules are really, really important when it comes to facilitator. But right team, right tool, right time, right data for me is a kind of a constant credo in that facilitation process.
I wanted to grab onto that last thing that you mentioned too, the awkward questions and those kinds of things. One of the things I noticed recently, and I wanted to throw it back at both of you too, is I think as facilitators, we're not owning that sometimes. We don't say that up front. We sort of just walk in and, you know, we start working with the risk lead and we do all the prep work and everything. But I actually noticed, I was doing one recently and I did some prep work with the team, and I asked a couple of questions and it was just two people I was working with for the prep work. And they said, ooh, that's going to be a sensitive question to the team. But they also followed up with, that's okay. And I said, this team has been going through quite a bit of growth and kind of pain together. And so I opened the session by saying, I am going to push on things. I don't know what they are all the time because I don't have that knowledge. I'm coming in here as this independent person, but know that that's just to get to the best assessment we can do, right? I want you to know I'm coming from a place where I'm asking genuine, authentic, honest questions to get us the best information to make the decisions we want to make for the objectives that this team is trying to achieve. And I'm not sure I ever really always established that with people. I just sort of kind of played the facilitator role, did the things I was supposed to do and asked all the good questions, but I'm not sure I owned that was going to be uncomfortable for people, right? And that we were going to quote, have to step into that discomfort, right? To bring in always my favorite Brené Brown. So I love that. I love that point. I thought that was really, like, all the things that you said were excellent, but I really wanted to glom onto that piece, that awkwardness and that asking the questions and the ask, don't tell kind of thing. Those are behaviors, I think, that we really need to look for in the person that's going to fill that role as well. I'm going to switch gears, because during this prep session that the three of us had to get ready for this podcast, Neely, you brought up a term that I really loved regarding SMEs and the idea of these knowledge stewards and how an organizational culture can drive those behaviors. Can you tell us a little bit more about that too?
Yeah, you know, my understanding is that it really, the concept of having SMEs in the room really kind of emerged from Q9. And yet when you go, because I know as part of my own research, I went back digging, like, where did this subject matter expert term come up? And where did we get to the point that, you know, you have to have these subject matter experts in the room? But, you know, it's a general consensus now that, you know, you can't just have a QA exec sitting in the back office filling in one of these things on their own. They need to have their colleagues and the SMEs around that product or the process involved with them. So, you know, we've built this concept in the industry of having these SMEs, and effectively what we've done is we have endowed them with superpowers. So they've got an extra stripe on their shoulder. They're maybe getting, you know, some extra dollars in their paycheck. They've got some kind of special ops status, where they're called in, you know, when there's a problem. And actually what we've done there is we've created a monster that is where we're saying your knowledge is power, and you own that knowledge and you own that power, even though it's organizational knowledge about the products that are in the portfolio. And we're actually encouraging them to hoard that knowledge rather than share that knowledge, because they get to be called into these special meetings when there's an issue, and they get to, you know, get the adrenaline kick of it. Now, I'm not saying all SMEs are like that, but we actually have created this monster where we're encouraging them to hoard their knowledge. I would love if we could, when that fairy godmother comes in to get rid of the FMEA, that she would also sweep off that title of SME with her, and that we would change all our SMEs into knowledge stewards. And they could be product knowledge stewards, or they could be process knowledge stewards, or they could be, you know, aseptic technologies or whatever their specialist subject is, but that they would become knowledge stewards. And as part of that job description, even by their title, they would know that it's about disseminating and sharing information. That is their key function in the organization, is not to hoard that knowledge, it's to disseminate that knowledge. And we know from all the other research work that we've done in TU Dublin with our colleagues, Marty Lippa, who's been on the podcast, and Paige Kane, that is around getting knowledge to flow. We've got to think about that knowledge as an asset in the business. This comes from Paige Kane's doctoral work. And we've got to think about it as an asset in the business. And we also have to think about almost our business as like a pipeline, and getting that knowledge to flow through the pipeline. So it's that liquid gold flowing through the pipeline is what we want that image of. And those knowledge stewards are curating that knowledge and directing it to the point right person, right time, you know, who needs to make that decision. And it also brings with it the fact that, you know, there's succession planning there. So they're working on the next spurts. They're working with the next generation, the new millennials and the Gen Zers, and getting them into understanding, becoming experts in a process or a product. So just by their very, by changing their title, obviously it'd be great if we could change the structure of their job description and put some percentage of time into that curation and dissemination of knowledge. But that for me is the most important thing. I cannot tell you how many risk assessments I have arm wrestled with, difficult or challenging, or, you know, SMEs with egos, and where you're begging them to share the information, you're dragging it out of them. And that is just, it's futile and it's unnecessary. But it's on us. It's not on the people. It's the culture that has created that. And as an industry, we have perpetuated that. So it's we need to change that. And I think that would be, again, when SMEs come into a risk assessment that I'm facilitating, I clearly have already had that conversation. I want you to come in with your knowledge steward hat on. That's why we want you here today. You know,
I love that phrase. And I also love your description, because I've had a few where they're the key knowledge steward, so to speak. And I'm moving my schedule constantly because they can't get in there because they are the key. So, and I used to call it cottage industries. You've phrased it in a different way, where they've sort of created their own little, sub industry within the industry, where they're the only person that knows how to do this thing. Right. So I love that. Tiff, what are your thoughts on knowledge stewards?
Yeah, I mean, so I love the idea of the knowledge steward versus the knowledge hoarder, right? So like, and to your point, Nuala, we have absolutely done that to ourselves. As a facilitator, kind of the only thing you can do in that realm is kind of encourage that conversation, manage that SME, and create that space to share. But I think as an industry, that concept must look so odd from an outsider, these knowledge hoarders that just kind of walk around within their own company holding this information. But as a whole industry, we've created this phenomenon. And I think it's the combination for what you said with like the different pay grades and the power and the title that comes with that, and the fact that we reward firefighting, right? So that combination of things to kind of reference something you said earlier creates this really bad paradigm. And it's going to take a while to flip the script on that, I think, because it's so ingrained in how industry operates. But I think a good way to see that, or a good way to start that, I've seen with some organizations in the risk management space, is to change how they're tracking some of their metrics, right? And so normal risk programs want to track, how are we doing according to the schedule? How many risk assessments have we done this year? How many are we identifying? Blah, 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 blah. So many metrics. Get rid of the ones that don't mean anything, because a lot of those don't. But if we can start talking about, maybe let's start tracking the number of harms that we've realized that we didn't identify through risk assessment. How many things did we know about maybe, and we just didn't say anything or write down, or we're hoarding something that came to light and we incurred harm for, and start highlighting those and start incentivizing the sharing of that knowledge proactively, to your point, before anything's realized.
I love that. And we don't do that, right? I think that's fantastic. So I don't work in the vaccine world in the industry. I'm actually in rare disease. Tiff, you had the opportunity during this entire pandemic to do some work with the vaccine industry, which I was riveted by when we were prepping for this and preparing for this podcast. And you talked a little bit about how the world had changed, right? And I think a lot of us saw across the industry, things were sort of shifting, of course, where the focus needed to be since we were dealing with a global issue. Can you share some of the things that you shared with us when we were prepping for this, share with the listeners, how this pandemic kind of changed risk management / knowledge management, and how we're developing processes in the industry?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I had an opportunity to work with both some vaccine clients and some therapeutic clients. And it was amazing to see this work being done. Not only because I've never seen anything happen at that speed, to be able to help so many people. Usually we work for an organization that it's either a rare disease and we never see, like we have less patient contact, but to work on something that we knew everybody that was gonna get this was amazing. But in terms of the risk world, for years and years and years, Lori, I've been delivering training with you for a while. We've always been saying, use risk, use it proactively. It can help you develop things. It's going to work. And it takes a lot of time to get there. We almost needed like a giant global event to make this happen. And coincidentally, it did. But it was really cool to be a part of these organizations, because we saw these great organizations really use the QRM lifecycle as the vehicle for process development and as a vehicle for knowledge management. And so to your point from earlier, Nuala, using those the lighter touchpoint tools at the beginning, when we really didn't, nobody knew anything about COVID when it first started, right? So we had to capture what we knew, get everything down, use this as the forum that captures the knowledge that everybody can use. And then we were learning things really quickly. So as we started to learn things, we would continuously revise these assessments. So that became the place where all of the knowledge of that process is as current as it could be. And it came down to, you know, it was really cool to watch. Weekly risk register meetings became the central forum for discussion points and for decision making and for tracking. And everything kind of, the whole project seemed to revolve around the risk space. And I'd never actually seen that in action before to that large degree, but it was so, so rewarding and nice to be able to see that and to see how much success it brought on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just so energized to hear that because I think it's the actual opportunity we had to show that this really does, if you use it right, it really works, right? And I think you were able to probably go through that experience, you know, in real action. And it must have been exhausting too. I think I commented on that before.
Yeah. So it's like, and that's again, so one of those facilitator tips, right, is to not have someone sitting in a room doing a risk assessment for 8 hours. They're going to burn out. It's a lot to do. But if you can handle a little bit longer as a facilitator, you can like bucket separate risk assessments and kind of do them back to back. So several things can get done at the same time. It's exhausting for the facilitator. Don't get me wrong. Needed a vacation at the end of that, but totally worth it. And it was a really great way to kind of line that up.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think that was really great for me to hear that experience. More being in the rare disease space, it was more negotiating CMO world for us as we were sort of battling that space for the vaccine world too. So speaking of the pandemic and tips and tricks, you kind of started to dive in there. That's changed a lot for those of us that facilitate. We went from being in a conference room with chairs and flip charts and all kinds of things at our disposal to suddenly being in our house, and everyone else was in their house too. And it was a big adjustment for me. I'm a person who definitely likes to have the, you know, flow charts going and things posted on the wall. And suddenly I didn't have any of that at my disposal anymore. And I was always one to bring the scoring sheets and everyone would have access to that. And we're all staring at each other. And so I wondered if we could kind of dive into what your favorite sort of tips and tricks are. And I can kick off, and I kind of alluded to it already, is I do love flip charts and lots of paper and post-its. And it's weird, like, you know, halfway through the session, I'll look around the room and I'm feeling like our brains were energized, ideas were flowing, you know, post-its are everywhere. And there's something about that for me that's very engaging. And I lost that a little bit. So I learned how to flip, though, quite a bit in terms of how to do this, because with brainstorming for risk assessments, I no longer walk in with that blank Excel spreadsheet that I talked about at the beginning of the podcast. And I always do a really informal brainstorming to get people kind of going at first. I switched to using a tool, either mind maps, or there's a tool called Mural that you can use where everybody can interact, everybody can be in it at the same time. And we're all putting virtual post-its in there, and we're talking through the brainstorming, facilitating with mind maps and connecting those things. That was my switch. I actually rather enjoy it now. After a year of it, I've kind of become quite accustomed to it. And now I'm having that reverse effect of, oh my gosh, I don't want to go back into the, that's a whole other podcast on remote work and now going back to the office. So I kind of want to jump over to Tiff. What are your sort of things that you learned, especially being a consultant and a variety of audiences you had to work with? What did you switch up to start doing?
Yeah, sure. So 100% leverage your technology. The first and most important thing is turn on your camera. We have such kind of exhaustion from all of these remote meetings right now that a lot of people's first instinct is to just show up with like your initial or whatever. They can't see your face. And I think turning that camera on really encourages that engagement. It really limits the multitasking, I'll tell you that, excuse me, on the part of the SMEs. But I think, you know, also like focusing that screen share. And so if you're using either a Zoom or a GoToMeetings or anything, there's a chat function on there. There's screen sharing, and that's how you can really engage, especially if you have SMEs that you need to hear from that are quiet or that they're not really talking to you. You can say, hey, you know, I know you have the most current version of this map. Why don't you share what you have on the screen and we can all talk about your thing? So I think, you know, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, because remote facilitation, you have to be 200% more aware of heuristics than you would have to be in the room. It's sometimes very easy to tell people's expressions and see how they're doing in the room. But especially if you have people who have their cameras off because they're not comfortable having them on, you really have to engage with people at a different level. And so this could even mean, you know, I've had instances where I had really nervous SMEs that didn't want to upset the larger team, but they wanted to get their point across. And so I have several monitors in my office. And so I would have the company chat function on a separate screen. So the team couldn't see it, but that quiet SME could say stuff to me. And then I could say, hey guys, have we ever thought about, you know, what about this? And so it took the weight off of that SME that was nervous, but it still got the point across. And so there's a lot of kind of technological workarounds that you can use to get remote sessions working based on anybody's level of comfort. And I know that generally we sometimes start these processes with icebreakers. And that's something that we talked about in our prep meeting. And I think, you know, those quiet people tend to get fearful of icebreakers. And so I like to keep them simple. I have a great colleague that has recently started asking at the beginnings of trainings and facilitation, what's one thing that you learned to do differently during the pandemic? And that's something that we've all had experience doing something different. And so people can just share that way and kind of connect with each other. And one of my fallbacks is always sharing a picture of my dogs, Kevin and Murphy. And as soon as someone sees a picture of someone else's pet or kids or whatever, they'll share theirs. And so that kind of gets people personally connected, because right now that's what a lot of us are missing, that connection point. So I think if we can start to foster that space, it makes people more comfortable with each other and a little bit more comfortable participating later on when you transition into the actual assessment.
I love that. Sometimes I'll even just ask, like, oh, what'd you guys do this weekend? You know, people start listening in the chat and everybody has like a good little, you know, 5 to 7 minute little conversation. It's kind of fun. You get to know each other. Sure. I also like the multitasking comments you made. I actually even hold myself accountable when that started too. When we started doing Zoom and they kept saying, oh, you can turn your camera off when you want. I noticed myself drifting when I was turning my camera off, because I wasn't held accountable anymore. I could be like doing this. I could be, you know, in my over somewhere else, you know, as long as I was still able to hear them. And so I actually like it to hold myself accountable a little bit too. And I've given up on makeup, guys. It's okay. Simplify my life. And then I wanted to ask you both at some point too, if you've ever tried the polling function for scoring. I thought that might be kind of interesting, very unbiased. We're not just waiting for the loudest voice. So that's something I was going to play around with and try to.
Yeah.
And Nuala, what do you have?
Just on that answer, I have used the chat feature, not just the polling, but just the chat box, and say, okay, everyone, score now, enter your answer now. And they all just do it simultaneously. And so if it is a numeric score, if it's a high, medium, low, whatever, again, you're getting that secret ballot piece that we would like to avoid, the heuristic of that anchoring and adjustment piece that we talked about with Randy that day. So I've definitely used that. And actually, to Tiff's point as well, one of the other things I like to do is make sure that people have my cell phone number when I'm facilitating. And particularly if there's a couple of key folks in the room, I encourage them to WhatsApp me, using a completely external channel, so they can WhatsApp me if they're, and I don't think, you know, this is going so well, or that wasn't where I wanted it to go, or have you thought about, or make sure you ask, as well as using that chat, that, because most of the chat features, no matter what forum you're using, you can just reply to the organizer or just reply to an individual. But it does mean I'm absolutely with Tiff on this. It does mean your work as a facilitator in a virtual world is 200% harder, because you're trying to watch all of these different channels and keep the flow of the piece going. I think for me, the most important thing is I am 100% behind, get that camera on. Unless there is some absolute reason, like you're walking your dog or something, there is absolutely no way you should not be having your camera on, because you can't, we're already so isolated. You absolutely have to have the engagement on. The gray square with the two letters and the muted microphone, what a turn off, Dialogue is the unit of work for a team, and if you can't get dialogue, and as much of your dialogue happens in looking at people and making eye contact with them as much as that what you're hearing them say. So the camera's on. For me, break it down. I mean, where we might have traditionally gone in, done a one-day session to do a risk assessment, there's no way you can do one day with one team on Zoom. It's horrific. So break it down, you know, less than 2 hours if you can. If it's going to be a three-hour session, then make sure you take a break, a decent break in the middle. Make sure you're frequently getting people up, walking around, encourage them. Okay, let's take a 5-minute, go and get your coffee, you know, come back to the screen at the top of the hour. You've got to try and break it up and get people to stay engaged. I the screen share is great, and I like that idea of rotating the screen share around, you know, trying to break, you know, set people with different time. Okay, you're the keeper of the process map, you're the keeper of the floor plan, you know, and then they have to switch it up. But the other piece is that it can get a bit exhausting when you're screen sharing and you're now everybody's teeny, teeny, tiny at the top of the screen. And maybe I'm just getting old, but I find sometimes you just need to turn off the screen share and get the faces back up again when there's a bit of dialogue going, and flip it back and forth. So don't always have that screen when, particularly if you're not actively filling something in that's relevant to everybody, or you're not showing them something that's relevant. If you're filling in your tool, you get the faces back up, get them talking to each other, is a key thing. I know when we talked about this previously, facilitator burnout, because the facilitator is really working hard in these sessions. So I have used a standing desk. I have one here behind me. I routinely say, okay, that's it. I can't sit any longer. I have to get up and move around. Obviously, caffeine and believe in the process. So lean into the tool and let the tool lead the process. You know, make sure that it's not rambling off into too many, cul-de-sacs, and get yourself back on. Okay, so this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to do this section of the risk assessment. We're looking at this section of the process and stick with it. You know, try and chunk it up, so you're not eating that elephant one, you know, in one go. You're trying to do it one bite at a time, and you're making that clear to everybody what the expectation is. We've got an hour session. We're going to get in, try and get through this piece in this hour. So stick with me, and then we'll give you a break and we'll get back. So they're just some of the things. The other thing that I would say is really important for me is you've got to recognize the different kind of mindset that's needed for the risk identification phase, that, you know, surfacing of issues, looking for potential harms and hazards. And getting that part is much more, to your point, a brainstorming type activity. And I've used those, and I've also used, just on PowerPoint, you can get little, like what look like a little posters, and you can make them in different colors, and you can have them all stacked up. I've had them, you know, like 50 of them stacked up on the side, and then you just drag them over and type them up, and oh, that's a yellow one and that's a green one, because you've got some color coding going on. So even something as simple as that, but that brainstorming requires everybody to sit back and think outside the box. That's a completely different mindset to the day that you have to then come in and say, okay, what's the likelihood of probability? Where's the data? How many of these have we had? Are we scoring this? You know, are we in agreement? So definitely segregate those two. And the research shows that, you know, you shouldn't be trying to do those two things in the same session or even in the same day. And you may even need different people for those two sessions, you know, with some overlap, but you may need some different folks. So, you know, really break it down and make it clear what you're trying to do in the sessions that you're doing. Make sure that everybody's doing well. Do check-ins, you know, how's everyone doing? Are we doing okay? Are we still here? Does anybody need any time? Okay, you know, and you know, make it part of the process that they can throw their hand up and say, okay, burnout, that last piece, that I'm cooked, I need to go and have a walk in the garden or a cup of tea or whatever it is, and make that space available, you know. Mm-hmm.
And to that point, from me. Yeah, Nuala, to that point, I think if you're the more kind of open and vulnerable you are as a facilitator for those kinds of feelings, the more you'll start to see either the team kind of become more cohesive, like, I'm exhausted, how do you guys feel?
Yes.
It starts to let them know that it's okay, that it's not just them. So I think creating that space is really important. That's a great point.
I love that. I'll usually own it. I'll be like, you know what? I have to go to the bathroom or I need a cup of coffee. Let's take 15. And everybody, I think, feels like, okay, she's open to that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they feel like compelled to have to stay with you, you know? I love this. This is so great. So let's close out with some last thoughts on kind of, is the facilitator friend or foe? And how do we build this strength into our organizations? All the things that we've been talking about today. And I'll kick off a little bit. I'll say the facilitator can be both. So if they can be friend, if we train them properly, we bring the right people into that role, and we actually give them the space to do this job, right? Mm-hmm. They can be foe, and they can tank your risk management program real fast if it's super painful, really drawn out, inefficient, incorrect tool chosen, things like that, not asking the questions, all the counter to what we talked about today. So I think it can be a really very important position or role for your program on either side. And so I'll just say too, that I don't think facilitator role is for everybody. I don't know how much both of you have experienced this, but when I ask for facilitators, sometimes I'm told by leadership, oh, this person has time, you know? They can go facilitate, their project ended recently. And I'm very clear about what I'm looking for. This role is very tough. We've just gone through and described that in this podcast. It can also be very rewarding. I love it. I mean, I get all like, ugh, before the session. And then after the session, I'm like flying high, right? Like, this was great. You know, I pulled so much information, like the engine was churning, the team was really going. And then there's days where it's really rough, right? You know, it's like, oh, there was a lot of conflict. We didn't understand the scoring criteria. We really struggled, you know, with this topic. But I love that moment too, because I see those as learning opportunities and challenges that we can overcome as a team that typically make that risk assessment stronger. So those are personality types and behaviors and skills that really need to be present or taught in that person, and to play the devil's advocate, to put yourself out there, to be vulnerable and asking the stupid questions, right? Or the dumb questions, we call them, or the probing questions, the curious questions, maybe we should phrase it that way. That's a behavior I think that we need to have. And it's something that I can work with people on though too, if, as long as they're open to exploring. Like, I have a lot of facilitators right now who ask me that. I'm really uncomfortable when I'm in a space where I'm not the knowledge steward, to use Nuala's words. And I'm afraid to ask those questions. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. And I actually am okay with that. And I'll tell you why, because I'm okay with not being the knowledge steward. I really am. And I'm okay with asking those questions. And so that's a comfort level people have to build into. So these are some of the things that I'm thinking about. And that role must be accepted by leadership. The leadership teams must give people the space to facilitate, to do the prep work, to be able to get the teams together. That has to be acknowledged as well. So I'll turn it over to to Nuala. What are some of the, or sorry, to Tiff, what are some of the things that you're thinking about in terms of that, and how that, those behaviors and skills, and how we build that in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, so facilitator 100% friend, as long, to your point, as we've got that competency set. I think that, you know, a lot of organizations see the facilitator as like someone we can put in front of everybody that can lead this meeting. And it's way more than that. We don't allow people to go do aseptic filling without proper training, qualification, mentoring, showing us you can do it, and testing them, right? And so why would we treat a role that's critical like this any differently? And so I think, to your point, I think that's really, it's critical. I think it's a very specific personality type that usually does pretty well with it. And it's gotta be something that they wanna do. This can't be something that you've assigned somebody, especially someone that's nervous, because it's not gonna go well. They're gonna be nervous. And so I think putting a lot of thought into that is really important. You know, I think, and we have to be okay as if these people get in this role and they don't like it.
Oh yeah, great point.
I've recently, within the past month and a half, I've co-facilitated with someone, kind of mentoring them in the system, and they were like, you know what, I hated that. And it's like, good. I'm glad you realized that. Don't sign up for them again or tell someone that you don't want to do this, but you're allowed to say that. This is not something like you're stuck with it now. Sorry, man. And I think that these are all important things to think about, because not only is a facilitator the friend, but I think in a lot of instances, they're the reason that these succeed. So I think we have to kind of see them that way.
Love it.
From my perspective, again, the competency model is very important. And actually, one of our previous guests, Gada, has done a lot of work in her research around competency models. But for me, a lot of the competency that the facilitator needs are not necessarily, those kind of QRM competencies. Of course, they need to be fluent with the tools, but it's much more on the soft skills side. So an expert communicator someone who might be a good project manager, to your point, Tiff, who's very good at kind of managing to-do lists and getting schedule and budget. And, they may not be the right person for to become a good facilitator. You're looking at someone who can do good situational leadership or coaching, who's a good coach, someone who's good at asking those questions and follow-up questions. And to the point that you just made, Laurie, on the bad days, those soft skills around managing conflict in a situation of being able to have those difficult conversations without offending people, and focusing on the problem, not the person, and being able to do that. So there's a whole host of skills very much aligned with kind of coach. It could be almost a continuous improvement. You might find some of your folks who are on the OPEX side of the house who are very good at this, looking at things differently when they're looking at opportunities for improvement. And they may well make an excellent risk facilitator without necessarily coming from a QA background. In fact, some of the worst facilitators that I found are folks who are brilliant QA auditors. They're brilliant at internal auditing, but it becomes a very check the box kind of, time and motion study type thing. And they're the absolute, antithesis of what you would want in a facilitator. So it's much more those people skills. It's about getting the dialogue. It's about, yes, you want to extract the information and you want to have it in a formal process and get it into the tools and that. But really, it is about that critical thinking skills and being able to encourage that safe place for everyone in the room to be able to speak, and recognizing that someone at the back of the room or at the back of the Zoom hasn't raised their voice or raised their hand. And being able to, reach out and say, well, we haven't heard anything from you, in a while. Why don't you jump in there? So much more on the soft skills side and much less on the technical know-how or know-who. So, that's it for me.
All right. So you've convinced me. The facilitator is our friend. As long as we train them appropriately. I love that. Yeah, I think we need to give them the space and the coaching and the mentoring. And that's where we need to come in and step in and do that. So Stacey,
thank you all. I think there was a great discussion here today, and definitely some tips that should empower teams to be more successful at this process. So thanks to all of you. Nuala, what are our takeaways from this episode?
Yeah, so look, I have lots of resources, but there's one particular Harvard Business Review article that I've read recently that I love, and it's about asking good questions. So that's going in there for sure. And I think we should provide the link for that lovely book. It's a tiny little, it's a read on the back of a train or plane if we ever get back to traveling ever again. But that lovely little book from Edgar Schein, The Art of Humble Inquiry, Ask, Don't Tell. So they're my two key takeaways for this.
Fantastic. We'll also include links to the past podcast with Randy as well that you mentioned. Yeah. So we'll have those three takeaways for our listeners today. I want to thank our Risk Revolution leaders, Lori and Nuala, for putting this session together for us today. Thank you as well to Tiff for sharing your expertise. Really appreciate it. Also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen. And lastly, we are so grateful to you, our valued listeners. Thank you for your continued support. If you enjoyed this episode, we remind you to subscribe in your podcast player of choice. And don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, and online networks. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, we'd love to hear from you about that. For today's show notes and information on this podcast, including the links to those three takeaways, please please visit www.ivtnetwork.com. We'll be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, make it a great week.